You may be seated. I'd like to invite you to turn to the back of your bulletin where you will see our assorted proverbs on giving as we continue this series of looking at proverbial themes and understanding what the way of wisdom, life indeed, the sage life looks like in regard to the people of Israel and their understanding of how you connected God to everyday issues and matters of life. Last week we looked at some proverbial answers and responses to matters concerning wealth and poverty. And I began by asking you that very silly question, would you rather be rich than poor? And of course, I assume that most of us would immediately say, oh, that's obvious, we'd rather be rich, which I guess if you have to prefer one over the other, that's the one that I would prefer with you as well. But we found when given that same question, Agar the wise in Proverbs 30 offers the only prayer in the book of Proverbs. And it's a very interesting prayer because his answer to would you rather be rich or poor is not I'd rather be rich or I'd rather be poor, but I'd like neither. He says, give me neither poverty nor riches, but give me only my daily bread. Enough for the day, enough for the moment. I just need enough. The reason is he understands the dangers of both poverty and wealth. The danger of poverty, otherwise I may have too much and disown you. I'll become self-sufficient. I'll become greedy. I'll get so focused on how all of my needs are met by my wealth that I'll say, who needs the Lord? What's that matter? Or if he becomes poor, I may become poor and steal and so dishonor the name of my God. He understands that both extremes have their challenges, and he has a healthy fear of both. A fear of being impoverished, and a fear of being, believe it or not, too wealthy. Which makes this a hard prayer for us to pray honestly, because there are other prayers, I think, that we'd prefer. We're more likely to pray, and in the last 2 weeks in our country, this would be obvious, we're more likely to pray, God, help me to win the lottery. If I win the lottery, I'll give you 10%. You know, 10% of 1.6 billion is an awful lot. So, you know, I'll take my share and you can have your share as well. I've always loved Tevye. Tevye in The Fiddler on the Roof, I liked so much about him. But he's so honest and he's so much like us when he says, Lord, if wealth is a curse, may the Lord smite me with it and may I never recover. That's his prayer. Smite me with wealth and I hope I never recover. Well, that's the way our prayers tend to go. They don't have this moderation. They usually go toward extremes. And that's one of the reasons 18 years ago to this day, there was a book that came out in 2000, The Prayer of Jabez. And all of a sudden, there was this wonderful discovery by some that there was hidden away in this little book of Chronicles, this big book of Chronicles, there was this prayer that perhaps if we prayed it more, we'd truly experience what God really wants from us. And there's a reason why the church gravitated toward this prayer and a reason why the church very quickly rejected it as a central prayer. The church gravitated toward it because it's a wonderful prayer. Oh, that you would bless me and enlarge my territory. Give me more stuff. If I had more stuff, more land, just give me more and let your hand be with me and keep me from harm so that I'll be free from pain. More stuff, less pain? Who wouldn't want to pray that? I mean, that's a prayer for the American culture. We want more stuff. We want less pain. However, this prayer quickly fell out of fashion when people that do liturgy and others that read the whole of the Bible understood that Jesus' model prayer for us is not like the prayer of Jabez. It doesn't ask for a lot more stuff and a lot less pain. Instead, it actually incorporates that phrase, give us this day our daily bread. We just need enough, which is Jesus' way of connecting it to Agar's prayer. Give me neither poverty nor riches. I just need enough for today. Well, the reason we lean toward prayers like the prayer of Jabez or Tevye's prayer or Lord, help me win the poverty so I can give you 10% is we happen to live in the same culture. You and I are victims and also victimizers within the same consumer culture that lives and breathes and eats and thrives on constant consumption. Consumption that is never satisfied, that is always looking for just a little more so that our word is never enough. Our word is always, it's never enough. It's never enough. We're assaulted. You're going to go home today. And after you get past the wealth of political ads, thank God, 9 more days, they'll be done. After you get past those, then you're going to be indoctrinated by a steady stream of advertisements that are constantly seeking to stir up your dissatisfaction with what you have. That are telling you over and over again that your present lot in life is miserable. You do not have enough. You need more. And what you have is pathetic. It's the past model. It's not the new and improved. It's the more recent model, not the newest cutting edge model. I mean, how many different types of models of car do we have to have? I find it interesting, you know that Buick commercial that's out lately, where everyone's seeing Buicks everywhere, and I'm sure it's stuck with me, so the commercial did its job, but I just think, isn't one Buick enough? You know, the couple's going out, they're going to their beautiful Buick, and yeah, this is a great Buick. Well, look at that one on the sign. That's another Buick. Wow, if we had that one and this one, maybe we'd have enough. But we all know it's a sham. We know that with that kind of indoctrination, there's never enough. We know that we live in a culture where we're deemed fuddy-duddies if we have last model's car instead of this model's. If we don't have the latest fashions, if we're not on top of styles, if we don't have the fastest acting item on the market, the good life for us, the good life, which is what Proverbs are about. Wisdom is always, what is the good life? The good life for us is marketed as obtaining more and more stuff. And when you have more and more stuff, then you're living the good life. And the more we believe it, the more happiness eludes us. Again, how many in our culture believe that if they just had a little more, then they could finally be happy? Isn't that what's behind the lottery craze? If I just had more, then finally I'd be happy, because I'm miserable up till now. I need more. But the problem is, how much is enough? Billionaire Howard Hughes was once asked, Howard, how much is enough? And you know his answer, a little bit more. That's how much is enough, just a little bit more. And when enough is defined as always something more than I have now, then we never have enough. Because enough is always about having something more so that I could finally be happy, secure, successful, and important. So the question for giving, the question really comes down to, how do we move from never enough to enough is enough? And the first thing we do is recognize how unattractive it is to never have enough. That's why I love that first proverb that Tom read. It's a visceral proverb. It's at the top of your list. The leech has two daughters. Give, give, they cry. Three things are never satisfied. Four never say enough. Sheol, the barren womb, the earth ever thirsty for water, and the fire that never says enough. What our Proverbs writer does is he goes through some very unappealing imagery, particularly in his culture, most of them in our culture, although one's a tragic figure in our culture. And he says, you know, the leech, much like the mosquitoes that were inundating us all about a month ago when everything was so wet, they never have enough. They just want to suck and suck and suck like vampires till they're bloated beyond belief. And even then, it seems like they could get a little bit more. And he's trying to put in our mouths a bad taste so that we say, yeah, that's not good. Leeches just never have enough. Then he goes forward and says, you know what else never says enough? You know what's never satisfied? The grave. Because there's always room for one more. You know what else is never satisfied? And this is a tragic figure in our culture. But in Israel's culture, this was a figure that was very vulnerable. The barren womb, someone who could never, ever have a child, was placed in a position of extreme vulnerability. And there was this constant, insatiable desire, only if I could fill my womb with a child and have an heir. We move on to ones that make more sense in our culture, the barren earth. The idea that you can just saturate it with water, and particularly in Israel's climate of desert, you know, it just could never get enough water. The earth could keep sucking it up, and you'd have less and less of that very important resource of water. And then finally, fire. It just keeps consuming. You light one match to a building, and if that fire takes hold, it won't have enough until the whole building is completely swallowed in flames. The point our Proverbs writer wants us to see is we've got to define enough as not something more than I have now, but we need to be able to say there comes a point when enough is enough. And the only way to counter these very unattractive pictures of insatiable desire is to show very attractive pictures of those who finally settled and said, I have enough. In fact, I have more than enough. And so the more than enough I have will be shared with others. The antidote to this desire for extreme poverty is the willingness to say, you know, there is a beautiful, abounding blessing in giving. And so our Proverbs writer wants to give us at least four, and there's more if you read through the whole book of Proverbs and through the entire Bible, at least four wise things about giving, things that make the giving life a good life. And at the top of the list, as you'd expect, because this is the book of Proverbs, trust in the Lord with all thine heart, lean not into thine own understanding. It's about fearing God and taking God seriously. At the top of the list is this idea of the second proverb down, 3 verse 9 through 10. Honor the Lord with your substance and with the first fruits of all your produce. Then your barns will be filled with plenty and your vats will be bursting with wine. Now notice that's from chapter 3, verse 9. If you go to chapter 3, verse 5, just four verses previous, trust in the Lord with all thine heart. Lean not into thine own understanding. In all thy ways acknowledge Him, and He shall direct thy paths. This big emphasis in the book of Proverbs to trust God, to seek God, to try to follow God. And at the top of the list of what it means to do that is honoring God with the first fruits of produce. Honoring God first. Putting the money where our mouth is. Honoring God with what we've been given. So that honoring God, giving, is not a tip, but it is the first fruits. It's what's given first with an awareness that God is the one who owns all, and God has given this, and therefore we give out of the abundance that God has given us. It's wonderful that our kids sang from the Sermon on the Mount, seek ye first the kingdom of God this morning, because right before Jesus says, seek ye first, make this a priority, He says, why do you worry about where you'll sleep, where your clothes will be, if you'll have enough clothes or if you have enough food. And this is Jesus speaking to an impoverished people, not people like us that are middle class or more. He's speaking to impoverished people. And He says, why do you worry about food and clothes and all these things? The birds of the air don't worry. The flowers in the field don't worry. But what I call you to as my followers is seek first the kingdom of God, and all these things shall be added to you. That same kind of first fruits reality is in Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. That's why when we give during our service, and we give to support our church, and we give to support the ministries that we're committed to, and we give to help those through benevolence throughout our community and beyond, and all kinds of other things, when we give, there's a sense in which it is not just kind of thing we're obligated to do. It's something that we need to do as followers of Christ. So I've always liked, Mark Labberton has a wonderful book called it's on the second slide. It's called The Dangerous Act of Worship. Because in his mind, worship always counters the cultural's prevailing values. And he says, in worship, this is what happens. The offering of money is a key moment in our worship. We live in a culture that worships money and neglects or forgets God. We are meant to live worshiping God and slaying the idols in our lives, including money. When the time for the offering comes each week, the practice helps us remember what belongs to us and what doesn't. It's not a cheap way of buying off our conscience or buying God's love. It's meant to be an act of surrendering our first fruits and facing down the power of money, status, achievement, self-absorption. In the offering, we practice turning over our power. In the offering, we say God is first. And we honor the Lord with the first fruits of what God has given us. We're able to say we have more than enough. And enough is enough. And because enough is enough, we're able to give. The second thing the wisdom writer wants to say that is a wonderful value in giving is that it allows us to personally prosper. So he has our self-interest in mind. He understands that we're going to answer the question, would you rather be rich or poor? Always with the answer of, well, we'd rather be rich. We want to personally prosper as best we can. And so he says this, the middle proverb there, verse chapter 11. Some give freely, yet grow all the richer. Others withhold what is due and only suffer want. A generous person will be enriched, and the one who gives water will get water. The first two lines are what are interesting to me. Some give freely, and yet they continue to prosper. It's like the candle that lights other candles. It continues to have the same light it had before, but it's able to help others in its vicinity. Others withhold what is due and suffer want, and others are misers. We're coming to Christmas time, and it might be a little too fast for some of you. I know it just seems the years fly by, and I can't believe Christmas is already almost upon us. Some are trying to hold it at bay with Halloween and Thanksgiving, but your shopping stores haven't done that, and I'm sure the radio stations won't do that either. It's going to come at us. It's a wonderful time of the year, and no means to complain, but when Christmas comes, we hear the same stories again and again, and one great story, which really seems to counter our cultural values, is that Christmas Carol story where Scrooge, a very wealthy man, sits and misers all of his stuff. It's all for him. He doesn't care about tiny little Timothy or any orphans or anyone who's any difficulty. Everything is about him and him scrounging together in his very small world all his wealth, holding it as a miser. Well, have you ever thought how miser is the root of miserable? There's a reason why Scrooge is miserable. He is this second line in our proverb, they withhold what is due and only suffer want. He's keeping it all for himself and he's absolutely miserable until, of course, he gets haunted. And then he gets haunted by some ghost, and that's why I like the Christmas Carol. It's really a horror story. For those of you who don't like horror stories, you're watching a horror story. The ghosts come in and they haunt him and they show him where his life is taking him if he does not change course. That if he remains like this, he will not prosper. He's going to end up miserable and alone. And through this life lesson, he awakes from the nightmare, the horror, and all of a sudden realizes the world is larger than him and his own little kingdom, and that he has more than enough. And so he goes and helps Tiny Tim, and he gets blessed by Tim, and it's just a beautiful story that really kind of goes against everything in our consumption and consumer culture about Christmas. It really just kind of knocks it all away and says that's not really the point at all. The Apostle Paul says the same thing. He's influenced by the wisdom writers when he says, the one who sows sparingly will also reap sparingly. The one who sows bountifully will also reap bountifully. The one who gives also receives. The third thing that he demonstrates that wisdom shows us about giving, and this is the one that really hopefully touches us deeply because we long to reflect and to shine God's character into our world, is that giving is an opportunity to reflect God's heart. Chapter 19, verse 17, it's the third from the bottom of the Proverbs. Whoever is kind to the poor lends to the Lord and will be repaid in full. And the reason why that kindness to the poor, that generosity to the poor, is lending to the Lord is because the Lord's on the receiving end. The Lord is for those who are being benefited. Because the Lord has what scholars have called a preferential treatment for the poor. There's a UCC daily devotional. It just came out today. I read it this morning when I was eating my cereal, and it's about blind Bartimaeus. And the pastor writes about how is it that blind Bartimaeus' voice got through to Jesus when there was crowds around him and there was all kinds of, you know, cacophony and people screaming and people excited. And yet the one voice Jesus hears is blind Bartimaeus saying, Lord Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. And her response was, the reason why Jesus hears him is because he reflects God's heart with a preferential treatment for the poor. Those who have enough can cry, but the cry that God hears most clearly and most profoundly are those who are in deep need, who need to be heard, who are in such a desperate situation that when they cry out, the Lord answers. Well, what's interesting is we are God's answer often to the poor. We are the ones that are called to be God's hand and God's feet, to make sure that we lend to the Lord, knowing, and I love the proverb, look at it again, whoever is kind to the poor lends to the Lord and will be repaid in full. That's the wisdom of the wisdom writer, that this is not something that will lead you to your downfall. This is not something that will make your life miserable. Instead, your life will flourish. It will prosper. It will be blessed. Which leads us to the last and final reason that the writer speaks so eloquently and wonderfully of giving. It's an opportunity to bless others. Look at the second to the last proverb. Those who are generous are blessed, for they share their bread with the poor. Here's the opposite, our final proverb. Whoever gives to the poor will lack nothing, but the one who turns a blind eye will get many a curse. Jesus said, it is more blessed to give than to receive. He does this because he understands that in giving we're reflecting the heart of God. God so loved the world that God gave his only Son. That God gives out of the abundance of what God has so that those who are in desperate need might find life and find joy. And in that process, the divine blessing overflows. So that you have this wonderful set of ideas of why giving is so good. It's an opportunity to honor God. It's an opportunity to prosper. It's an opportunity to reflect God's heart to others, and it ends up blessing others in the end. That's life indeed. That's why you come to our reading that we have a senior pastor writing to an upcoming pastor in 1 Timothy when he says in verse 17, those in the present age who are rich, command them not to be haughty or to set their hopes on the uncertainty of riches, but rather on God, who provides us with everything for our enjoyment, so they are to do good, to be rich in good works, generous, ready to share, storing up for themselves of a treasure, of a good foundation for the future, so that they may take hold of life that's really life. That's the apostle's way of saying, so that they might live the good life. That they might know what it means to live a life of meaning and value and worth and significance in a world that God has created. This is presented before us, the beautiful opportunities of giving, so that we will be repulsed by the alternative. So that we will understand, you know, if we never ever can get enough, we always seem like we need more and we're hoarding it and keeping it to ourselves, we end up looking like the leech or like the grave or like the consuming fire, and we miss out on the blessing of true contentment in giving to others. Our life becomes more like a hell than a heaven. I want to end with this illustration. I used it probably 6 or 7 years ago, so you probably forgot it. It's a beautiful illustration of how giving is really a taste of heaven in this world. It's a story about a man who was brought before two doors, and he was told, behind this door is hell, behind this door is heaven. And he was told to go through both so that he could see the conditions of both. And so he went through the first door, and what he found was that there was a table in the midst of this room. It was surrounded by people who happened to have on their hands these very, very long forks strapped to their hands. And in the middle of the table, within the reach of all of their forks, was this bounteous, overflowing bowl of stew. And yet, every single person at the table was emaciated. They were famished. They had the means to get to the stew, but because the forks were so long, they couldn't put the stew into their mouth. And they were emaciated. They were famished. And the man told the one who went in the door, that's hell. So he came out that door, he went into the door marked heaven. Identical situation. Big table, big bowl of stew in the middle, people with these long forks strapped on their arms, but everyone was happy. There was joy, there was contentment. It just blew the guy's mind away. He said, it's the same thing. What's the difference here? And as he came out, the mentor told him, well, here's the difference. In heaven, they've learned to feed one another. So that they take their forks and they learn to give to the other. In hell, they can get to what seems to satisfy, what seems to be enough. They just can't get it to their mouths because the only interest is in giving to themselves. That, dear friends, is a picture of why giving is so beautiful. It's so much more like heaven than a hell. So may God help us to be fountains of abundance rather than leeches and sponges. May our life not be endless desire like the grave, but may it produce endless blessing through generous hands, that we might know the blessing that Jesus speaks of in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Give and it will be given to you. A good measure, pressed down, shaken together, running over, more than you can imagine. It will be put in your lap. For the measure you give will the measure you get back. We can only move into that blessing when we move from never enough to enough is enough. Would you pray with me?